This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This show is brought to you in part by the Art of Charm podcast. Everyone, and I mean everyone, can get better at communicating and connecting with others. And doing so can significantly improve every aspect of your life. Job interviews, love and marriage, creative collaboration, all of these things depend on interpersonal skills. The Art of Charm podcast is a fun, practical, powerful, and best of all, totally free way to up your game while you're commuting to work or doing the dishes. It's fun to listen to and packed with immediately usable advice from people who know what they're talking about, including leading psychologists, Navy SEALs, management gurus, and more. So go to theartofcharm.com/podcast or find The Art of Charm in iTunes or Stitcher and start taking your life to the next level. Hi there, I'm Jason Gotz, and you're listening to Think Again, a Big Think podcast. Big Think is an online forum for big ideas from the world's most creative thinkers and doers. With the Think Again podcast, we're in uncharted new territory. Short surprise clips from Big Think's interview archives launch spontaneous discussions on everything from life on Mars to whether everyone, yourself and myself included, is a liar. My guests and I have no idea what to expect. Today I'm joined by stand-up comedian and comedy writer Ian Edwards. He's written for The Boondocks, Saturday Night Live, Keenan Ivory Wayans Show, and a lot more. And his first stand-up album, which is hilarious, was just released on Conan O'Brien's Team Coco Records, and it's called 100% Half-Assed. Welcome to Think Again, Ian.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah.
Thanks for telling me all those things about myself. I didn't know.
Is it all true?
No, it's all true.
Okay, cool. All right.
I'm not going to dispute it.
All right. So I guess I want to start really meta and ask you what you think makes something funny versus not funny.
Most things have like a mathematical equation. It's like this plus this has to add up to this punchline. That's like, to me, the basics. Or you're going along a straight line and then you make a surprise turn. Or the time when something is said.
So timing is kind of a mathematical equation, or it probably could be measured mathematically, but when you're doing stand-up or you're trying to figure out if a joke works with a team of comedy writers, it's more about feeling it out. Is it like trial and error?
There's trial and error and there's calculatedness to it. You gotta always keep on experimenting and trying different ways to make people laugh. You shouldn't just stick to what you're comfortable with, which is tough when you got formulas that work, you know what I'm saying?
So do you think that eventually the guys in Silicon Valley will be able to make an app to replace you?
To replace me? Hopefully not.
Or any comic.
Yeah, hopefully not. Yeah.
Comet.y.
Well, yeah, have a robot show up at the club. Yeah, you don't have to pay him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, remember the guy that won Jeopardy a lot?
Right.
MIT, they built a computer that beat him. So, yeah, it's possible. They could do that, like make a robot comic. That's just funny as shit.
Well, I think that once they figure out that comedy piece, they're going to be pretty far along the AI road. Because I really do think that humor, that like leap of thought that it takes to make that surprise connection, you know, that makes something really funny, like that's one of the things that is hard to replicate.
Yeah, hopefully.
We'll see. Well, let's get into the meat of the show. So my producers have chosen three clips for us. They are a surprise. I don't know what they're about. We're going to watch
them. Me neither. We're in the same boat.
Yep. So let's see what we have first. Okay, well, this is from someone named Daniel Bergner, and I think we're just going to have to be surprised by what it's about because there's no clue.
We as a culture have a ton invested in monogamy. It's the kind of social glue. And I think we all, if we're honest with ourselves, have some level of conscious or unconscious fear that if we really toss monogamy aside, our society would kind of come apart. Even though we've begun to question monogamy, I think, seriously as a culture, it still defines our romantic dreams. It defines what we think we should be as parents. And it's very convenient. It's very soothing, calming, that we've told ourselves this story that while men may be animalistic and anarchic when it comes to sexuality, women are, again, by comparison, fairly well suited to monogamy. They can serve as that coherent force. Nice for society, nice, of course, for men. I get to think that my partner is all about me, even though I might, in coming to speak today, have checked out any number of women as I made my way down the street. So calming for me, but too calming, I would say, too convenient, socially speaking, too convenient for men. Women are drawn to the novel, and that makes monogamy just as much of a problem, sexually speaking, for women as it is for men.
Monogamy is probably one of the hardest things in the world to do. You know what I mean? Like I know guys that love their woman to death and would jump in front of a bullet,
right?
But might fuck another chick.
Right.
You know what I mean? It doesn't mean you don't love the person. It's just tough. Like, especially walking in New York City, there are so many different beautiful women out there, or just attractive, or mentally attractive. It's just, like, if you pull off monogamy in a lifetime for, like, 20 years in a relationship, you've done better than anything David Blaine could do, or just any magician, and you should get credit. Like, Obama, as a president, he has everything a woman would want, and you're gonna tell me nobody's flirted? Like, the biggest thing he's pulled off in these 8 years of being president is not cheating on his wife to me.
Assuming that's the case.
We
want to assume that, don't which, we?
Yeah, I
want
to assume that.
I don't want to think of Obama cheating on Michelle.
That's a lot of pressure.
Like, I think a lot of people felt that way about Kennedy, you know, JFK, mm-hmm. and, like, many years later were, like, probably in complete denial when they learned that...
I still am. You know, those were the good old days.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I guess monogamy is hard, although I guess it depends on sort of the size of your superego, you know, like the level of fear that you may have for what might happen, you know, like how high the stakes are in terms of your relationship, who it is that you're with, you know, how much you don't want to destroy that. And then, yeah, just your personal level of schoolboy guilt around like what might happen.
And despite all that, men still and women still cheat.
I think what makes it still one of the kind of mysterious things about human society is that we all, or most of us, are going along with this arrangement. Maybe we're not. I don't actually know what the numbers are. Yeah. But a lot of us
like mostly everybody.
Yeah, we're talking about this is the idea. We're going to find somebody. We're going to stay with them and be more or less monogamous. And everyone knows it's difficult.
Right.
Men and women.
But we act like it's not, or it's not supposed to be. We don't give it the credit that it deserves. Like, if I'm with a woman for 20 years and I only cheated once, you got to give me something. You got to, just once?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but she, you know, the likelihood of her giving you that credit is slim.
It's slim. It's slim. It's like, it's over. And then if it's not over, then they'll never forget it and it'll ruin all the other great things. Vice versa. Go both ways. If the man gets cheated on a woman, they may never forgive or forget.
I just wonder whether this is one of the things where we are just failing to take human nature sufficiently into account, and we just haven't designed the situation properly, you know?
Like, I feel that, too. I'm with you. If you're saying we're not supposed to be monogamous, like, I would like to know where monogamy came from. Like, something I heard about marriage was why people got married in the first place, you know, just to have kids so that they can have a family and, like, farm the land, and it's from back then, and... We're in an industrial age now. We're not even past industrial. We're in a technical age now.
Yeah.
And it's like life has changed, but not this thing, monogamy.
To get personal about it for a moment, I mean, I'm married and I would not be cool. Like, I cannot imagine an arrangement in which I am cool with my wife being with somebody else. Like, that's not, I would freak out.
How often do you have sex?
Now, I don't know if I want to go into into my sex life with my wife right now, but I'm not sure I'm prepared to go there. I don't know. Comedians are brave. But I heard someone once propose this situation that if you go away from home, it's okay. Like, if you're traveling or whatever, all bets are off kind of thing.
It says like a baseball contract. Like, you can... You can fuck chicks on the road, but none in town.
Something like that. That's okay for both partners. They never talk about it. particularly, it's just nobody the other one might know, and that's how that is. And
I mean,
that's the arrangement.
That's superhuman nature. I mean, that's idealistic if everybody's could get their ego under the control to the point where they can accept that. That's actually spiritual and outer worldly to just, when you're living outside of the concept of monogamy and it works. Like, those are special human beings. I'd love to be one of those special human beings.
Like, not to freak out even about the person being on the road and be like, who are they with? What are they doing?
Yeah, I'll just, like, if I was going to do it, I'd just say, hey, protect us. Yeah, but I don't know if or think I'm man enough for that.
Yeah, I'm not. You I'm definitely saying? Not. I mean, I know this for a fact because years ago I was briefly with someone who wanted to have an open relationship and I tried that and it was like...
It was hell?
It was hell, yeah. It lasted for 2 minutes, man.
What was a part of it that you didn't like?
It was all like acceptable more or less until it came her turn, you know?
Oh, okay.
Which is not... And
no,
now
no, but
I can hear the women in the audience going like, oh, double standard, but it's not an intellectual thing. It's just like, I mean, conceptually I was fine with it until she did it, but then when I learned that that had happened, I was... That was a total wreck.
You don't know how devastated you're going to be until she does it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I was fine with it. I was on board. Like, I was like, do what you like. But then when it came to it, you know, the nature bubbles up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's more to say on this, but I think let's see what they have for us next.
All right, let's see.
All right, cool. So this one is from Stephen Dubner, the guy from Freakonomics. And it is about the gun debates.
One of the reasons that the gun debate in this country is so contentious is that there's very little good data on who owns guns and what share of guns used in crimes are illegal guns. But, you know, one proposal that I like a lot is to create kind of a national firearms safety administration, something like the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, which collates transportation data. So if we want to know about what really causes, you know, there's still 30 to 35,000 traffic fatalities a year. That's a lot. Considering how much we drive, it's not that much, but that's a lot of death. The more we know about how every accident happens, the better we can do at preventing. Similarly, with something like guns, the more we know about how guns are used, how they get in the hands of the people who use them for crime, you know, the vast majority of guns are never, ever, ever, ever used in any crime. Most laws that we make to protect people from guns are usually ignored by the criminals and obeyed by the law-abiding people. And so I think that if you had better data, there'd be no one more in favor of it than law-abiding gun owners, because they don't want to be smeared and lumped in with the criminals who use guns. So that's where data can be a kind of different tool in the arsenal when you're trying to make better policy or public policy, because otherwise you're just kind of shouting at each other with your ideology rather than understanding how people actually behave.
This show is brought to you in part by the Art of Charm podcast. Who knew that plays well with others would turn out to be the most important thing on your childhood report card? Whatever you're trying to achieve in your life, it depends on connecting with and persuading other people. So why is that the one thing they don't teach you in school? Instead, we think of charisma as this mystical, elusive force that you either have or you don't. Nonsense. The Art of Charm podcast offers practical, immediately usable advice for networking, public speaking, negotiation, finance, fitness, and more, based on solid clinical psychology and tested, replicable, real-world success, not pop psych speculation. Also, it's a thoroughly entertaining listen. There's nothing manipulative or magical about becoming a better communicator. It's a set of skills you can learn, and there's no good reason to spend your life held back by bad interpersonal habits. Go to theartofcharm.com/podcast or find The Art of Charm in iTunes or Stitcher and start taking your life to the next level. And now, let's get back to Think Again. I mean, I can't disagree that data is useful,
right?
But if the data were to show that even one person with a registered gun left their gun out somewhere and their toddler came and shot someone or themselves with it, that would be too much, I would think. Even if that's just one, you know?
But I just think accidents can happen with anything. Like, just like he said about the 30,000 people get killed in a car accident.
Right.
Like, cars are definitely never made to hurt anyone. So even some kid puts their hand in a socket or swallows a fork. There's always going to be accidental fatalities.
Sure.
I don't have a gun. I didn't grow up in a gun culture, but I am pro-gun for this reason. I like the reasons the Constitution has it. And if you get rid of guns, there's no guarantee you're going to get rid of all the illegal guns. Like, if all the people that bought the guns legal, so those people have guns.
Right.
I think it would be beautiful if the place was like England or Australia where the cops didn't even... If the cops didn't have guns, then I'm down for nobody to have guns. But because cops have guns and cops seem to be really out of control right now, I don't want to live in a country where citizens don't have guns to defend themselves if push comes to shove.
Okay. You know what I'm saying? All right. So you're looking for, like, not forward, but you're envisioning the, like, citizen uprising counter the overly aggressive police.
Yeah, I think the cops ultimately, knowing that citizens have guns too, will temper their aggression towards citizens.
Huh.
That's why it's not as bad as it could be, you know, because we have rights. In the back of your mind as a cop or as an authority figure, you know, if you want to try to take some shit over, you know citizens have guns and it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. I mean, I can certainly understand that, you know, particularly in communities where the cops are really out of control and like that fear can be a reasonable deterrent.
Even the militias and those people that have guns, you know, the cops don't really go in on those people too hard because they know they have guns.
Right.
And they let them hunt and do shit. And maybe in this part of this country where they let them get away with more with their guns just because they have guns.
Yeah.
You know, so I always just keep that in mind. I don't want just one section of the population to have guns and nobody else. How would you control yourself if you knew you were one of the only five people that have guns? You would be an asshole.
Right.
It's nothing. I'm one of the only five people in this country with a gun.
Yeah.
Well, that makes
sense. But then I don't want like a nuclear weapon. I mean, you know.
Yeah, there shouldn't be any nuclear weapons.
Yeah, okay.
But I would go with no guns then. Nobody has guns.
Right,
you know,
right.
You get rid of all the hood guns, all the illegal mob guns, and you get rid of all the regular guns, and you take away the cops' guns.
I think you do
it like England.
I'm for that. I'm for that. Is that the case? The police in the UK do not have guns?
No, they have special police that have guns, but, you know, like some at the airport.
You lived in the UK for a while.
Like, I grew up, the cops didn't have guns.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Just a baton or whatever.
Just a baton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The argument I don't really buy is the argument of, like, you can't do anything about it. We do hear that from the, like, pro-gun folks who like, oh, there's no way you're going to get all the guns. Someone's going to have a gun. It's like...
They're saying that because they don't want you to do it.
Right.
So that's their way of, like, you're wasting your time.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people, when they hear you're wasting their time, will think, oh, shit, I'm wasting my time. Fuck it.
Right.
And let them have their guns.
Right.
So that's just... They hope it has a numbing effect.
I wonder about the analogy to prohibition. This just occurred to me. This may be like a half-assed idea, but I'm just thinking
Let's go for it.
Yeah, let's see. You know, 100%
half-assed. Yeah. You know what it made me think of? What if there was something that was better than guns, that was nothing like guns? So that, you know, people who like guns and want guns, they're in love with them.
Right.
They're hobbyists. And they're in love with them. But if somebody could come up with something that was just better than guns, that would occupy the mind of people who love guns, then people would spend their money on that thing and go away from guns.
So what do they want out of guns? They want a few things.
One,
there's that kind of like manly feeling you get. I've been to a gun range once.
I
am a peaceful man. I have... been in one physical fight in my life because I was drunk at a party, but it felt good to shoot that gun, you know?
I mean, based on what you're saying, this is all up to women.
But the mothers of all those Dylann Roof guys, like, they're all gun owners, but anyway.
But this is what I mean.
If
every woman is like, the manly thing is to not have a gun. And they just start, like, fondling men without guns. Like, I love a man without a gun. This is so sexy. You know how being a nerd now, you used to get beat up when you was a nerd.
Right.
Now, nerds are getting all the chicks. So guys that aren't nerds are pretending to be nerds and girls that aren't nerds are pretending to be nerds. Like, people are, like, doing Star Wars crash courses, like studying it, knowing all the names, getting all the T-shirts.
Right.
And being a nerd is the thing. You could do the same thing with guns in the opposite way. Like, if you don't have a gun, that shit is sexy. And guys would be like, fuck guns. Because ultimately, what we love more than guns is women and sex with women. And it. So this comes down to women. You know?
Yeah, well, so it comes down to culture, right? Because, like, in New York, as a hetero guy looking for girls, you know, and showing off your gun, like, you probably would not get very far.
Yeah, because you know, we're in a city where we don't really need them, you know?
Right.
We don't have to hunt anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and because we value other things, you know, arts and other aspects of culture, you know, rather than hunting and...
Yeah, we need a substitute, but it, I guess in the sticks... where there's things to hunt, and you could still be the primal, I'm going to use caveman as a guy.
Right.
Like, some of those things still apply. You could drag home, literally, the thing to eat.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, guns still count, but we just need a substitute.
So I don't know what would ever substitute for that.
But whoever comes up with that substitute, it's going to be a billionaire.
Absolutely. I mean, I was thinking, like, virtual reality will give us some of that, but, like, not the visceral reality of the whatever they want out of the dead deer.
Exactly.
Which I don't want, but, you know. Hey.
Right.
All right. So, cool. Round three. Yeah?
All right. I'm down.
All right. Sex, guns. Let's see if we get rock and roll next. Oh, okay. This one is sort of in your area of expertise. Teaching science like comedy with Bill Nye, who's kind of both a comedian and a scientist.
Mm-hmm. No one's ever asked me that before. That's pretty good. How is science education like comedy? Well, you want to get people to choose to embrace it. You always want the student to figure it out for her or himself. You don't want to give her or him the answer if you can help it. Actually, maybe that's an excellent analogy to the... Steve Martin's point was, as I understand it, was that the funniest time is when you say, well, you had to be there. The reason for that was because you've chosen to laugh. So if you challenge the student to come up with the answer for her or himself, then he's chosen to do that. She has chosen to get the answer. And so it makes it your own. As we say... having somebody do it for themselves is worth being told about it 1,000 times. And so what you want to do is arrange science education so that students have hands-on experiences. And everybody talks about this all the time, but it's a whole nother thing to actually pull it off, to actually do it that way.
I've had a lot of teachers, some in school and some just in life. Like, I came up with a bunch of comics who ended up being smart, like Patrice O'Neill, Bill Burr, Norton, Keith Robinson. You know, there's just a lot of thoughtful comics, like Louis, one of them. And you watch their stand-up, you can learn things from them. And these are people you have conversations with at the Comedy Cellar all the time. And they're all teachers in a sense, you know what I mean? I used to date this girl right out of high school, and her mother was basically a saint. And she taught me how to be good in this time when there's so many distractions and opportunities to be bad.
Right. So, yeah, like those sort of mentors, formal or informal.
And then, very informal mentors. That make you like push your mind and think past the point that's right in front of you.
I can see what you might mean about comics, you know, being generally good teachers or a lot of them anyway. I mean, comedy, it seems to me, especially stand-up, like, you've got to be really introspective. You've got to spend a lot of time thinking.
But I don't think I would normally do that and be introspective and self-aware if I was in another line of business, if I was working in a factory or something like that.
Right.
And I think those things are important. And like he said, you want the student to figure things out for themselves. You kind of lead them to the water and then they drink it. So I've ran into people who have affected me in a contagious way where after I've run in with them, I've continued to train the thought on by myself and been in the discovery mode of finding and looking and searching and learning stuff on my own.
Right.
Some of the best teachers I had, like non-school teachers, they were just honest. And like even learning honesty is a huge thing, you know?
Right.
Because you can skate by in this world without being honest. You can get far without being honest. Mm. But It's just such a valuable, honestly, such a valuable thing, especially in comedy, man. It's just, it's one of the funniest ingredients is honesty.
So I think a lot about this. Like, I don't think it's possible to be completely honest. I just don't. I guess I want to ask you, like, sort of, how do you understand honesty, like, given that we conceal a lot of ourselves? Like, what does it mean to be honest?
It means a lot to me to be honest. The more honest I am, the better I am as a person, and also the better I am as a comic.
You know, I mean, I don't mean is it important. I mean sort of what is honesty, you know?
What is honesty?
Yeah.
Honesty is honesty.
You know, for example, with stand-up, like, mm-hmm. what if you feel that night, like, what if you're super depressed?
Right.
Like, do you come on with that? Is that good, like, as a comedian, or are you, you know, should you come with some other energy?
I got a great answer for you.
Yeah.
You know Tig Notaro?
Yes, I do.
Her greatest night in stand-up that took her to the next level, she was at Largo, Louis happened to be there, place was packed, and she had just been diagnosed with cancer, I think that day, and maybe the week before her mother just died. So she's on stage and she's gonna do her act. And then she just started talking about being diagnosed with cancer that day, and it's a week after her mother died, something like that. And it was honest and it was funny, and it changed her comedy life.
Yeah.
You know, got her about a bunch of respect, and it took her to the next level. But so yeah, being honest, I mean, because you can be sad and funny. Like, I've seen people not talk and be funny. I've seen people be sad and be hilarious than somebody who's shouting and trying to. Right. Funny comes in so many different forms. You just have to know how to manipulate it.
Right. Ian Edwards, this was really cool. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me,
man. Think Again today. Once again, Ian's album of stand-up is called 100% Half-Assed, and it's on Team Coco Records, which is Conan O'Brien's label, and it is really, really funny. I was laughing out loud in the office here, which is a pretty sedate office.
It is.
Looking like, you know, an idiot, but being honest, I guess.
Yeah. See?
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks again.
All right. So that about wraps it up for this week's episode of Think Again. Last week, we had Sam Harris, and we got an amazing response to that. And also a lot of people asking why we were promoting it through iTunes as opposed to Android platforms. You can always listen to the podcast on Stitcher. We also post the episodes on our site, bigthink.com. But iTunes is our largest audience base, and it's the largest base for any podcast audience. So that is why we're tending to promote through there. If you are enjoying what you're hearing, and I say this every week, but I'm going to say it again, there is no better way to ensure that this show grows its audience and stays on the digital air than going to iTunes or whatever Android platform you're listening on and rating or reviewing us. A lot of you have done that already. Thank you so much. We'll be back next week with philosopher Alva Noah, who's written a book called Strange Tools about how humanity created art to achieve things that no other technology will do for us. We'll see you then.